Hello, I'm Earl Fontanelle, and you are listening to The Schwepp, the secret history of Western esotericism podcast online at schwepp.net. Oddcast episode, coming back for more, part 4, reincarnation in antique Judaism. Well, gentle listeners, this is going to be a short episode because the ancient Jews didn't believe in reincarnation. And yet. While many of our listeners will know that reincarnation is a standard belief in some forms of Judaism today, indeed I hope that some of our listeners are Jews who grew up in the Kabbalah-infused Lurianic flavor of rabbinic Judaism, wherein transmigration of souls, or Gilgul in Hebrew, is unambiguously taught, there is a strong consensus among scholars that we do not see evidence for a belief in reincarnation in ancient pre-rabbinic Judaism. Yes, Philo of Alexandria is an exception, but he's awfully Greek, isn't he? Even Platonist. So you'd expect that sort of thing. A deviation from the mainstream Judaism of his time. But, the consensus goes, we can tell a pretty succinct story about afterlife beliefs in ancient Judaism. The old school Jews from the Bronze Age wandering tribes who first began telling the legends and stories which make up the oldest sections of the Tanakh down to well into the rabbinic Middle Ages. This is, 2000 year Jewish history period. The old school Jews just believed that when you die, you're dead. And you stay dead. Now, this is correct, but we're going to come back to it anon, mainly because ghosts are involved, and ghosts are always good value. Then there arose, according to this mainstream story, sometime in the period of Hellenistic domination of the Jewish lands, so the 3rd, 2nd centuries BCE, under the Seleucid Macedonian dynasty, a new belief among some Jews, the sort of thing which we find in apocalyptic literature of the period, in which God, in the process of ending the world and bringing to pass the divine plan, is going to resurrect the righteous among the Jews, and they're going to go on to dwell in some kind of glorious afterlife. But we still don't see a Jewish soul-body distinction, as we emphatically do in early Pythagoreanism and Plato. So this is a bodily resurrection, not a cyclical reincarnation. So two options, an old school mainstream option of you die and then you're dead, and the new Second Temple notion of bodily resurrection, which of course goes on to become a mainstream sectarian belief among Jewish sects like the Pharisees, the early Christians, and will eventually become completely mainstream in the rabbinic period. And yet, it turns out that we have a number of interesting and troubling bits of evidence which might perhaps make us ask whether there wasn't some belief in reincarnation among Hellenized Jews from the Hellenistic period onward. What exactly did a, quote, mainstream Jewish opinion look like in the Hellenistic and later Roman period? Our evidence is very scant here. And new evidence of really odd things, like the goddess-worshipping Jews of the Egyptian island of Elephantine, or the Qumran scrolls, or Philo of Alexandria's work. All of these kind of outlying bits of evidence keep appearing, evidence which adds up to a truly vast range of possible options for Jewish belief and practice in the last centuries BCE, early centuries CE, such that some scholars talk about Judaisms rather than Judaism in this period. I'm not convinced by anyone's strong argument for what a normative Judaism looked like in this period. More on that anon. I mean, some things are normative, like a certain affiliation with the notion of Israel, things like that, worship of Yahweh. But other things seemingly had a huge latitude for differing. Furthermore, and more centrally relevant to our concerns in this series, we do have a few Jews from our period just straight out telling us that some Jews believed in reincarnation. More on that anon as well. So no, this isn't going to be that short of an episode. There's some material to discuss here, even if, spoiler alert, reincarnation in the sense we've been talking about in this series so far doesn't actually seem to have been that widespread as a belief in Second Temple Jewry, if it existed at all. I mean, it certainly existed at least among a few intellectuals. And yet, I love a good and yet. So let's get into our evidence here. So first of all, let's go chronologically way back in time and discuss the oldest evidence we have for Jewish afterlife beliefs. This is, for the most part, contained in the writings known as the Tanakh, some of which are very old indeed, although the complex textual sifting, which goes into dating the various layers, is still an ongoing process. It's beyond our pay grade here at the podcast, but see episode 11, where we discuss the higher biblical criticism and some of its findings. The Tanakh is a multi-layered document with many redactions, and it was composed and assembled over 1,000 years, something like that. Anyway, in some uncontroversially old parts of the Hebrew scriptures, we find statements like Psalm 6:5, "For in death there is no remembrance of thee. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks?" Or 2 Samuel 14:14, "For we needs must die and are as water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God respect any person." And there's, of course, the classic Ecclesiastes 8:8-9, where we learn that, quote, "The living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten." That's pretty straightforward, right? And also, this part of Ecclesiastes gives us the famous counsel that we should eat, drink, and be merry now, because there's not going to be any chance of doing so later. So all of this material is unambiguously "you die and then you're dead" type material. And this is the older Jewish view. It's also the view, even today, of some among more literalist Jewish movements like the Karaites. Now, also in the Book of Samuel, we have the famous tale of the Witch of Endor, who does some necromancy for Saul because he wants to speak with the dead Samuel. And it works. So this is obviously not exactly "you're dead and then you die." This is "you're dead and then you die, but ghosts exist." What we're looking at here is the very common, it might even be universal, standard Eastern Mediterranean stroke Near Eastern view of death that we see across Bronze Age cultures. The Egyptians are, of course, the exception here. The Egyptians have their own afterlife thing going on very famously. But for everyone else for whom we have evidence, from the Mesopotamian cultures to the Bronze Age Greeks of Homer's poems, the early Romans, and so on, when you die, you die. But something more or less like a ghost or phantom kind of quasi lives on in an underworld. This isn't an afterlife per se, because all our sources agree that A, it doesn't usually respect persons, so there's no special place for special people. In Homer, Achilles is just flitting around with all the other ghosts, even though he's the greatest hero of the Greeks, so there's no kind of heaven and hell. And B, it sucks. As Achilles says, it would be better to be a living slave on earth than king of all the dead. So you can call it an afterlife if you want, but it's not what, for example, in Judaism, when it starts talking about resurrection, will be seen as an afterlife, an ethicized sorting of the wheat from the chaff, and the wheat gets to go to a good place and the chaff gets to go to a bad place. These ghosts were real. So necromancy was practiced and believed across East Mediterranean cultures, and the visits of the dead to dreamers also seem to have been a consistent belief stroke practice among Bronze Age folks of the Eastern Mediterranean region. Ghosts were real, but they weren't souls in the sense understood by later theories of human beings. See our episode with Richard Seifert on the rise of the soul for more on that, and check out Daniel Ogden on Ancient Magic in episode 6 for some more on that good old Greek and Roman necromancy. So far, there's very little controversy among scholars, what we've talked about so far. We have no evidence in early Judaism for belief in what I guess we can call a meaningful afterlife, but rather a belief in a subterranean ghost realm called Sheol, which sucks, and where everyone's nefesh will go and sort of impotently linger on forever, unless a witch summons it up to speak with the living. Now, crucially for the story of Western thought and Western esotericism, things start to change in the Second Temple period. as we've seen in the podcast. And we start to see this belief in some kind of bodily resurrection appear in texts like the Book of Daniel, written in Aramaic around the year 165 BCE, and included in everyone's Bibles, which says at 12:2, quote, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt," end of quote. This is clearly a resurrection with a judgment. Similarly, and a bit earlier chronologically, 1 Enoch 22:27 shows a pretty clear early second century belief in bodily resurrection. See episodes 50 to 52 of the podcast for more on the Enochic writings and Second Temple apocalyptic more generally. Many more documents from the Second Temple period can be adduced here, and they all add up to a new belief emerging in Judaism, but certainly only believed by some Jews, that a resurrection is coming, then a judgment, and that those found worthy will go on to some kind of bodily afterlife. Because remember, there's no soul in Judaism of this period. The notion that there's this true locus of the human identity called the soul, which is separable from the body, just isn't there in the thought world. So what kind of afterlife do you have? Well, a bodily one, obviously, because what other kind of life is there? And these resurrected, justified people are going to be glorified, and somehow they're going to be near to God in the afterlife. This is usually expressed in the distinctive language of apocalyptic. They're going to have crowns, they're going to have shining robes, they're going to dwell in divine palaces, and so on. But we can see a doctrinal belief behind the imagery, one which all adds up to a picture of Second Temple Jewry roughly as follows. Lots of Jews still believe that when you die, although ghosts are a thing. But some Jews have started to believe, definitely from the second century BCE onward, that resurrection is coming, followed by an eternal, embodied afterlife with God. So that's kind of the background to the story we're going to embark on now. And here I'd like to quote Gershom Scholem's article on Gilgul, which he translates as Transmigration of Souls, Reincarnation, or Metempsychosis, in the Encyclopedia Judaica. So if you look in there under Gilgul, you'll find Scholem saying this, quote, "There is no definite proof of the existence of the doctrine of Gilgul in Judaism during the Second Temple period. In the Talmud, there's no reference to it, although by means of allegoric interpretations, later authorities found allusions to and hints of transmigration in the statements of Talmudic rabbis. A few scholars interpret the statements of Josephus in Antiquities 18:1-3 and in Jewish Wars 2:8-14 on the holy bodies which the righteous merit, according to the belief of the Pharisees, as indicating the doctrine of metempsychosis and not the resurrection of the dead, as most scholars believe. The doctrine of transmigration was prevalent from the second century onwards among some Gnostic sects, and especially among Manichaeans, and was maintained in several circles in the Christian church, perhaps even by Origen. It is not impossible that this doctrine became current in some Jewish circles who could have received it from Indian philosophies, through Manichaeism, or from Platonic and Neoplatonic, as well as from Orphic teachings," end of quote. Scholem then goes on to discuss the doctrine of Gilgul in the Kabbalistic tradition of the Middle Ages, where, as an oft-repeated academic quip puts it, it is as kosher as Mogen David wine, from at least the publication of the book Sefer HaBahir. And of course, we'll be talking about this Kabbalistic tradition in the podcast. Now, I'm definitely not here to argue with the great Scholem about Second Temple Judaism, but I do want to pull on a few dangling threads contained in this quotation. As for, quote, "some Gnostic sects and especially Manichaeans," and, quote, "several circles in the Christian church, perhaps even Origen," we're going to have to come back to all of these in later episodes. But what about this Josephus of whom he speaks so highly? And actually, while we're on the subject, what about Philo of Alexandria, whom Scholem doesn't even mention? Well, let us discuss both of these gentlemen, starting with Philo of Alexandria. Now, keen listeners to the Schwepp need no introduction to the great Philo, whom we called the first Western esotericist in episode 56. There I mentioned that although it isn't expressed exactly on the surface of his many writings, the great first century Jewish philosopher does teach a doctrine of reincarnation. This is my opinion, mainly persuaded by the 2015 monograph of Uli Karyanma, whose arguments will not be accepted by every scholar, but are nevertheless very strong on the face of it. Here are a few points that are relevant to the story of reincarnation. First of all, although Philo here and there echoes the language of Plato in numerous places, saying of disembodied souls that they can go espalingenesian, into rebirth, and palindromousin authis, they run back again. Although he does use these terms all the time, he never kind of lays out a theory of metempsychosis. He's clearly talking about metempsychosis by all sort of philological understanding of his work, but he doesn't just say, have a treatise on reincarnation. However, there is his work on dreams, where he pretty much does. He is alluding to descending and ascending souls moving into and out of incarnations cyclically. Although again, here he kind of brushes past these ideas rather than setting out to argue for reincarnation openly, as Plato often does, right? So in my view, Philo is just being esoteric here. He's writing for an audience of learned philosophers. They may be Jews, but actually anyone who is part of the trans-religious elite of hermeneutes, which is one of Philo's ideas, will be able to extract the truth from these texts, which is that souls reincarnate cyclically. Now, this isn't exactly provable, though the fact is, when you really parse what he's saying, Philo clearly is talking about cyclical reincarnation in On Dreams. It's there in the text. So what do we make of it? Well, what many interpreters make of it is that it's a kind of stylistic Platonizing thing, but Philo doesn't really mean it somehow. What Scholem makes of it is precisely nothing, as we've seen, and there's a reason for this. As we discussed in episode 58, Philo just doesn't exist as far as rabbinic Judaism is concerned. His writings do not appear in the Talmuds, he's never named in rabbinic literature, he's just basically erased from Jewish tradition. But among Christians, especially the early church in Alexandria, he is heartily adopted until in the fullness of time he even becomes an honorary Christian. There's this idea of a Bishop Philo who never actually existed. So that's the story of the reception of Philo. And if you are a Jew today, trained in a rabbinic academy or a yeshiva, you just may never have heard of this person. Although to a, you know, sort of classicist or someone like that, Philo is like the most important Jewish writer of the Roman period, right? Or one of them. Josephus would be the other one, and we'll get to him in a moment. Why the resistance to Philo, the reincarnationist? Because there really is a lot of resistance to this in the scholarship. I mean, we can all agree that Philo heartily Platonizes. He makes, and Pythagoreanizes indeed, he makes Plato into a plagiarist of Moses, and having done that, he can pretty much find any Platonic doctrine he wants in the text of the Hebrew Scriptures, read esoterically, so why not argue for Moses, the reincarnationist? Well, the reason across the board for this sort of denial, Philo seems to maybe be arguing for reincarnation in a kind of subtle way, but he can't really be, is that, as Scholem says, we have very little evidence for belief in reincarnation among Second Temple Jews. So either Philo couldn't have really believed it, or if he did believe it, he was writing esoterically so as not to anger his co-religionists, who presumably believed either you just die or you believe in a bodily resurrection of some kind at the end of days. Now there's a lot to unpack here, so join us next time as we discuss this matter with Sami Uli Karyanma and get to the bottom of reincarnation in Philo. I'll just say here, though, that Scholem's final thought that, quote, it is not impossible that this doctrine became current in some Jewish circles, who could have received it from Indian philosophies through Manichaeism, or from Platonic and Neoplatonic, as well as from Orphic teachings, is relevant here. Not the Manichaeans. They don't exist until the 3rd century CE, and we're talking about earlier period in this episode. And forget Neoplatonic, let's just think about Platonic and Orphic teachings. These were, as we have seen, certainly around. They were certainly major tools to be thinking with and or worshiping with in the 1st century BCE and into our era. And the only thing Philo likes more than Platonic ideas expressed as Moses' teachings is references to mystic initiation, expressed as the true meaning of philosophically informed Judaism. Thus, Judaism is the mysteries, and that includes notionally the wisdom of both Orpheus and Pythagoras. All of these traditions are dovetailed in Philo. Or they're not exactly dovetailed, they're just made into Judaism. Now, while it is true that Philo is an outlier in many, many ways, in the extent to which he is deeply Hellenized and philosophical among the Jews of antiquity who survive, if we pull back the lens for a moment and think about it, all Jews in this period were more or less Hellenized. The Maccabees had to write in Greek about how Jews should start speaking Hebrew, precisely because they weren't. They were speaking Greek and Aramaic. The rabbinic tradition forgets about Philo and all the other Jewish / Hellenic philosophers whose names survive but not their works, because the Talmuds are engaged in a process of tradition building with rather strict filters, rewriting the Jewish past, or at least filtering out parts that aren't of interest to the compilers. So the point is that Philo looks much less like a total freak when we remove these ideological filters from our view of history. Suddenly, a deeply Hellenized Jew at Alexandria teaching reincarnation, admittedly in a cautious and circumspect way, seems actually plausible and the sort of thing you might expect, right? Anyway, as I say, we'll come back to Philo, but now let's turn to Josephus. Yosef ben Matityahu, better known to history as Flavius Josephus, is a man we have cited probably dozens of times in the podcast, but I've never quite found the window of opportunity to talk about him in his own right. He is deeply fascinating. He is our single best source for the Judaism of the first century CE, by far our single best source. Weirdly, the second best source is probably the New Testament. And he talks about cool little bits of Solomonic magical lore and all kinds of stuff like that, which make him of great interest to the history of Western esotericism. But he isn't exactly Wesso himself. So Yosef was a prominent Jew from Jerusalem, probably from a priestly lineage. He says he's from a priestly lineage. But he had the misfortune of being such a person at the time of the first big Jewish revolt against the Romans. So before this war, Judea was ruled as a Roman client state under one King Agrippa. Not exactly independent, but not part of the Roman Empire. After the war, Judea has been utterly trashed by Roman troops. The Second Temple has been destroyed, and Judea is incorporated as a province of the Roman Empire. And Josephus is taken off to Rome as a slave. The personal slave of the military commander Vespasian. And this guy would later become Imperator, the emperor. Once in Rome, Josephus embarked on a series of learned writings, a history of the Jewish war, a work of Jewish history or Jewish and world history, known as the Jewish Antiquities, and various other works in Greek. He eventually won his freedom, and following the Roman custom of freedmen adopting their former masters' cognomen, he became Flavius Josephus, because Vespasianus, the emperor Vespasian, came from the Flavian family. So part of how Josephus, who'd been a military commander against the Romans, and who, among other things, had induced some of his troops to commit mass suicide rather than be captured, but himself decided not to commit suicide and see what he could sort of achieve as a prisoner, which turned out to be quite a lot. Part of how he made his successful way as a court captive and later as a freedman at Rome was to indulge in some Jewish prophetic antics of his own. Josephus had, it seems, discovered that the Jewish prophecies about future events had in fact announced that Vespasian, who was, a military commander at this time of the Jewish War, would eventually become emperor. When he did become emperor, Josephus was able to appear as either an infallible prognosticator or just a very loyal partisan of the Flavian claim to power. Either way, he was in, like Flynn, right? Now, we can only imagine the opinion of the Jews who survived the war about Josephus and what he did. But As far as the Romans were concerned, this was a good Jew that you could work with. Hence, he is able to live out this probably relatively delightful literary existence at Rome. Anyway, we're very glad that he did survive, turncoat though he may have been, because he wrote us these long detailed accounts of all things Jewish in the late Second Temple period, a period for which we have very few sources. And again, the rabbinic tradition, that's this huge corpus of writings which appears in later antiquity, this tradition seems to have wanted to forget a lot of what was going on in Jewry at the time. So we see Talmudic history through the lens of a very small, very particular elite of pious Jews known as the sages or the rabbis. And much of what was going on for the vast majority of Jews in the Roman period is just ignored. So Josephus is hugely valuable. Now we get to why Josephus is important for the study of Jewish reincarnationism specifically. As Scholem mentioned earlier, quote, "A few scholars interpret the statements of Josephus in Antiquities 18:1-3 and in Jewish Wars 2:8-14 on the holy bodies which the righteous merit, according to the belief of the Pharisees, as indicating the doctrine of metempsychosis and not the resurrection of the dead, as most scholars believe." Let's dig into this a little bit. Josephus tells us in the Jewish Wars at 2:119 that, quote, "There are three types of philosophy among the Jews, the Pharisees of the one type, the Sadducees of the other, and the third, which seems to practice the greatest piety, known as the Essenes," end of quote. Loose translation. Now remember, Josephus is writing for a Greco-Roman audience, not a Jewish audience. This is crucial for interpreting him. This is why, for example, he talks about these groups of opinion among Jews as philosophic hieresis. This is a way that Greeks understand different opinions, like sort of schools of thought, right? They're philosophies. Now, it's unclear which philosophy Josephus himself belonged to, if any. And it also is clear that Josephus isn't saying that all the Jews belong to one of these three philosophies. Quite the opposite, in fact. These schools really are like philosophies in the sense that from Josephus's evidence, only a small fraction of the population of the Jews as a whole engages with these schools. So no one can agree on the population of Jews at the time of Josephus in the Roman world. No one can agree on the relative sizes of these different sects among Jews relative to one another, or what proportion of Jews even belonged to one of these sects, if that's the right word. We just don't have enough evidence. A lot of scholarship, or a lot of discussion, maybe less than scholarly standards, seems to just assume that all Jews in the early Roman Empire belonged basically to one of these three groups, Pharisees, Sadducees, or Essenes. And not only is this unwarranted, the evidence, at least in Josephus, pulls quite the other way. These were small minority groups that just happened to have these opinions. Okay, now we know from Josephus and from other sources that the Sadducees are the old school Jews who deny any afterlife at all. So thank you, Sadducees, you can go. The Essenes are the ones who dwell out in the desert in special communities and practice stringent religious ritual and asceticism. They are often linked by scholarship in some way with the Qumran community who produced the Dead Sea Scrolls, and also with the Jewish sort of Pythagoreans mentioned by Philo, whom he calls the Theopeutai. That is a huge debate. There's similarities and differences. But at any rate, our evidence for the Essenes seems to pull in a direction of bodily resurrection. So we can also kind of say farewell to them. Then we have the Pharisees. These, on all our evidence, are the post-Enoch Second Temple Jews who hold that human beings will be resurrected. This is the school that Paul of Tarsus belonged to. And Paul, as we know, was really into the idea of bodily resurrection. At Acts 23:6 in the New Testament, he is called before the Sanhedrin. This is the top council of Jewish elders. And it says, quote, "But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question,'" end of quote. So he's both saying, "I am a Pharisee," and our main sticking point with these Sadducees is that we believe in the resurrection of the dead. But this is where the evidence from Josephus gets interesting, because Josephus tells us, if we look at the letter of what he says about the beliefs of the Pharisees, that the Pharisees believe in serial reincarnation with an ethicized element to it. Now, Scholem has said this is a minority interpretation, but in our next episode with Sami Uli Kariyama, we are going to look at what Josephus actually says from a sort of philological side, and it's clear that he's saying something that pulls very much in the direction of serial reincarnation. Now, a lot can be said about that, because even if you accept that Josephus is saying the Pharisees believe in reincarnation, it's very easy then to argue, well, he's talking about the resurrection of the body to a Greco-Roman audience who has absolutely no really frame of reference for this belief. It's just bizarre to them. But what they will probably be familiar with, at least casually, is Plato's idea of a separable soul, cyclical reincarnation, and so on. Or they might be initiates to a cult that teaches serial reincarnation. So they're going to have a frame of reference for it, and that's what Josephus is doing. He's putting the Pharisaic belief into a Greco-Romanizing context that his audience will understand. There's many other ways you can account for this, but the mere fact that Josephus, it can be argued, does say that the Pharisees teach reincarnation is very, very interesting. We'll return to it next time. Now, before we leave this discussion on that inconclusive note, I want to turn to one more idea which isn't exactly cyclical reincarnation among the Jews of this period, but which is very important for the story of Abrahamic reincarnationism going forward. I refer, of course, to the notion of the returning prophet. Keen listeners will recall episode 156 of the podcast, when we discussed the pseudo-Clementine literature. That is a relatively late, multiply redacted, very difficult to interpret body of material pertaining to some kind of Jewish-Christian milieu. But it puts us on the track of one idea which is definitely there in other sources as well, notably Jewish Christian works, namely the idea of a kind of reincarnation specifically among special people. The pseudo-Clementines speak of a true prophet who was Adam, and then he was a bunch of other unnamed prophets, and who has latterly appeared as Jesus. So this is a kind of reincarnation of a special prophetic person multiple times in history. I don't want to say a soul, because the idea of soul isn't necessarily germane to this at all, but a reincarnation of a person in some way, right? Now, we shouldn't read this as a Jewish, and Gieschen has rightly pointed this out in his 1998 study of angelomorphic Christology. It's not that we have Jewish Pythagoreans at this point. I mean, we do. We have Philo, but that's not what this belief seems to be pointing to. It is pointing to the idea that the prophet appears again and again in history, but that doesn't imply anything about a belief in a separable soul or astrally determined cycles of reincarnation or anything like that. It's just that there's some kind of providential plan. Prophets appear, but they may all be the same prophet. In the book of John, 1:19-25, in the New Testament, some Jewish leaders, Pharisees, incidentally, ask John the Baptist if he is the Christ, that is the anointed one, the expected Messiah. He says no. They say, okay, fine, well, are you Elijah? And he denies this as well. Why are these Pharisees asking him something like, are you Elijah, if they don't have some notion that Elijah, the prophet, is going to return in the form of another prophetic figure? They wouldn't ask that, which implies that they do believe that. Now, elsewhere in the New Testament, we learn that John the Baptist is Elijah. At Matthew 17:12, Jesus says, but I say unto you that Elias, which is another form of Elijah, is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them, end of quote. Now, this is usually taken to be a reference to John the Baptist. But even if it isn't, it is at any rate a very clear reference to the notion that Elijah has come again. at Matthew 12:14, we learn with greater certainty that John is Elijah. Quote, "And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come." End of quote. Good thing Christianity is a religion of peace. Thus, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. Now, that is a very clear statement that John was Elijah. And at Luke 1:17, we learn that John the Baptist has the spirit and power, the pneuma and dunamis of Elijah. Again, if you were going to talk about something that reincarnates in a cultural context where you don't really have a soul, you would talk about pneuma or maybe dunamis, and that's exactly what Luke theorizes. Now, I take it that these three different references to John as Elijah, from John, Matthew, and Luke, all represent slightly different takes on this single notion that Elijah is expected to return in the form of another prophetic figure, or at least expected by the Pharisees to return, and that one of the claims to authority of the early Jesus movement was that we've got an Elijah, right? The other thing you needed was also a Pharisaic notion, a Messiah, an anointed one. And obviously they claim to have that too in Jesus. Now, none of this is really evidence for a belief in reincarnation among Jews. Although some people read it that way, the sort of returning prophet motif is something I believe very, very different from the kind of cyclical reincarnation we've been talking to up until now that arises in the Pythagorean movement, has a very, very strong stamp put on it by Plato and goes on from there. But I don't think this is something we can just pass over in our discussion of reincarnation. For this reason, the returning prophet is clearly a strong belief among some Jews in the early Roman period. Most likely it is a Pharisaic belief, although not necessarily all the Pharisees agree on it. And probably our New Testament testimonial, where everyone has a slightly different take on what exactly it means and how it works, is a sign of this, right? And it's equally clear that the earliest Christians believed it, and this belief will appear again in a changed form when we turn to notions of reincarnation in Islam, where we also are going to see ideas of a providentially decreed serial reincarnation of special people in history doing God's work, sometimes alongside a more general belief in reincarnation, sometimes as a standalone idea, sometimes the two are fused in interesting ways, so you get a kind of cyclical reincarnation stroke returning prophet vibe. This is, I guess I would describe as, after the notion of soul-body dualism and cyclical reincarnation, which we will see enter into Christianity, very much from a Greek cultural nexus. This, I think, is the second main cultural stream which goes into forming the great Abrahamic reincarnationisms of later traditions, the returning prophet motif, with also sometimes returning Messiah stuff thrown in for good measure. In other words, going forward in our examination of Abrahamic ideas on reincarnation, this Second Temple belief, the expectation of a reincarnating prophet, adds a new element to the mix, which is going to interact with ideas of body-soul separation, cyclicality, and all that good stuff. Next time, as I say, we're going to look at the evidence from Philo and Josephus in more detail and with a specialist who really knows this material inside out. And he makes a strong argument for the minority position that these first century Jewish thinkers really were believers in reincarnation. Now, as I mentioned, not all scholars and perhaps not all listeners will be convinced by this, but if you're one of those, gentle listener, fear not, because reincarnation will go on to be an, as it were, mainstream esoteric doctrine among Jews, many of whom hold it to this day, although they still tend to speak of it with a certain circumspection, because the teachings of the Kabbalah are esoteric, and although they've been widely discussed by scholars, they nevertheless stay esoteric.